Hi, it's Yumi Steins from the Ladies We Need to Talk podcast. If you've never heard it before, let me explain it to you. Ladies We Need to Talk is a must listen that goes deep on the stuff that really matters to women. If it's a topic going off in your group chat, we're across it with love, science and real life women telling their stories, from perimenopause to the mental load, fertility to friendship. Find Ladies We Need to Talk in the ABC Listen app.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When was the last time that you saw a movie and found yourself falling right into the scene, fully forgetting that the people you were watching were paid actors who'd memorised their lines, because it all felt somehow so real? A big part of how a performer becomes another person is how they move. Is it fast or slow? Are they quick to laugh? Or do they hold themselves back? If they kiss, is it full of awkward longing or full of something else if they're a couple who've been together for decades? Lisa Petty's job is to help figure out these subtle but really powerful physical gestures and to develop them with the actors who are working out how to inhabit another person on stage or in a TV show or film. Lisa is a movement and intimacy director and a choreographer who began her dance career in New York in the 1980s, when the city was full of creative energy but also being rocked by the worst of the AIDS crisis. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Sarah. Lovely to be here.
I want to start with your work as an intimacy director, Lisa, helping actors with all kinds of romantic and sexually vulnerable scenes. Was that something that became part of your work really only after Me Too?
Well, the intimacy direction is really, as I see it, another arm of what I've been doing for the bulk of my life, which is, you know, physically telling stories. So the movement direction that I did prior to that was always consent-based. And I worked with the particular individual, their strengths, their interpretation of the character. When Me Too happened, it accelerated the consent-based practice. So I think in many, many situations it was already there, but it certainly accelerated, made consent-based practice a lot more public. So I've studied with IDC in America, and so that there's a lot of procedures you embark on and protocols that you abide by so that the actors are fully aware of being able to say what they consent to.
What's IDC, Lisa?
Sorry. It's Intimacy Directors and Coordinators. It's a, when I studied, there were really two primary bodies in America that were providing training. So one of them was Intimacy Directors and Coordinators, and yeah, incredibly thorough, incredibly sincere work that they do.
So when you're speaking with actors, say, in an intimate scene, you're talking about consent, and what else are you asking them? Like, what are you asking them to think about, I guess, in terms of their character when they're coming to that kind of scene?
Well, first of all, I have the conversations with them individually, and then I talk to the actors when they're together, and we talk about what we're really wanting, what the director would like, what the intention is of that particular scene. I think that probably the most important thing about intimacy direction or movement direction, always, we're always working to serve the director's intention for the scene while also fulfilling the actor's their interpretation of that particular character, and to respect both of them. So that's my job. I couldn't go in and decide on what I feel the scene is about, because then I'm telling a completely different story. It just wouldn't work. So I talk to them about where their character is psychologically, what their physical abilities are, their confidence with their body, how they would relate to the other character, how they would touch. And then I talk about all of the details. So a lot of movement direction and intimacy direction is really, is really detailing a lot of the work so that we might be thinking of the tension within their body, their focus, the rhythm, their timing as they approach that next person's, because the space between them, the space between all, us all the time is alive. And we'll... Oh, yeah, absolutely. And we'll... And reflects the... Our relationship with each other, our relationship with ourselves. So how does that character relate to that other person? How electric is that space? I mean, because, for instance, there might be a really intensely serious and intimate scene where there's a pause and a nothingness before they do touch, so that they're so quiet that they can... It's almost alive and they can feel the air. So when they finally do touch, it takes on this profound importance and intensity, as opposed to, say, if you're working on a comic scene where the timing is a lot faster and ridiculous and all over the place. And so we talk about all of those sorts of things and the details to fulfill a particular moment, yeah.
How tightly choreographed are scenes then, say, coming out of conversations like that? Is it almost like choreographing a dance piece?
It is very much a dance, but I certainly don't go in and we have a framework of what I always start with a framework with the actors, so they know of, you know, parts of their body which are available. This is for intimacy, but for movement direction, I do choreograph it, and we come back and say, okay, how did that feel? What did? And they make offers all the time. And I go with their offers, because they have been living and in working with their characters for a lot longer than me. They know their interpretation intimately. And so that they're free to say what works, what doesn't work, and gradually it evolves out of that. With intimacy in particular, I think it's really important. It's not over choreographed by me. It's really providing the framework, and again, going in and sort of saying, okay, well, now that, how does that feel? And now what about adding just a little bit more pressure or breath or averting your focus or leaving your focus for a little bit longer, maintaining that for a bit longer, and then we play with it. And because we usually rehearse before, it's a lot more efficient particularly in film, because if we rehearse beforehand, so that when it's actually performed, you don't have to take a lot of takes. You can really have a fine performance, and the actors are entering secure. And I think probably one of the most important things about this work is when the actors enter that space and they rehearse the scene, and you've set up that framework and boundaries and everything like that, that they know what's not going to happen. And that gives them crazy amount of freedom, because they feel safe. And therefore they feel, and when we're safe, we're creative.
Last year you worked on a new production of Hair, the musical, in Melbourne. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, when that show first came out in the late 60s, it was shocking because of the full frontal nudity that happened. Is it still something that's meant to be provocative, or is how even the way that we see a naked body on stage changed since the 60s? How did you work with that element in the show?
Well, the particular scene in Hair is a very strong political statement. So with all of the atrocities that were happening in Vietnam, by the time the characters arrive at that point, they've all been protesting against the Vietnam War and, you know, they're speaking at length about the ugliness of violence and aggression. So the scene when they take their clothes off, and there's 18, in this case, there were 18 bodies standing beautifully naked, doing nothing. It was a challenge to society. Tell me this is wrong, or tell me this is indecent or amoral when you're doing all of this in Vietnam. So it was a real confrontation towards, you know, using the audience as sort of the public of the 1960s then. In terms of how the actors felt, I don't think feel that the actors felt that it was as wild or outrageous from how the public would see it, because we certainly have been really exposed to a lot of nudity through film over the last couple of decades. But there's no doubt you are vulnerable when you are standing still without any clothes on a stage. So my job was also to help them feel safe in doing that, and making sure that, you know, we had warm-up exercises, and so we had focus on what this particular, being very aware of the intention of that moment and what they were standing for and being fully in their character was extremely important. Their focus, where they focused to show that pride and that defiance, was extremely important when they stood there.
What sort of things did they tell you after performing that scene live on stage? You say such a vulnerable thing to do, to stand in front of an audience naked, still.
Yes, yes. Much safer if you move, much safer. Many of them came up to me, and particularly the actors who had been nervous, very nervous, found it quite euphoric and freeing. And they were really surprised by that. I think a lot of that has to do with actually understanding, being able to understand what is the intention of this particular moment. And so that you're so involved in that focus that you forget the logistics necessarily of what you do. I mean, you do them, but you have got... you're so involved in the character at that point. And at that particular point in the play, in the musical, they're at the end of Act One. So they have been communicating a lot of their outrage to the audience and their own personal politics for some time, which is really great, and I think also helps the scene, helps the audience and helps the actors, yeah.
You grew up in Melbourne, Lisa. Uh-huh. Who lived at home with you at your place?
I lived with my mum and my sister Deb, and my nana and my aunt Peg.
Yes. That's a lot of women.
It's a very, very female heavy household. Yes.
Was your dad ever in the picture?
Yeah, he was. But my parents split when I just turned 8, I think, and we moved into my nana's, and my aunt also lived with my nana, and both my mum and my aunt had polio, were polio survivors. My mother survived very well. She was in Fairfield, I think, for 3 months. Peg was a lot longer. She was in iron lung for a year from the age of 11, and then so she was disabled from that experience, yeah.
After your mum and dad split up, Lisa, what sort of role did your mum take on with other women who were going through divorce at that time, which was still, certainly before Whitlam introduced no-fault divorce, still a really hard thing for a woman to do, to leave a husband?
It was... I think that logistically she found it hard because a lot of the laws were in place that prevented women from creating a new life. For instance, I remember when Mum wanted to buy a car and she couldn't sign for it, or when she had to have someone guarantee it, and certainly that was the same thing when she wanted to buy a home for Deb and I and herself. And they, you know, there was no check on the integrity of the men in terms of who was signing for it, but it just that a woman couldn't. So when other mum was certainly the first person, the only one that I knew who had left her husband, and I think that a lot of the community did not have anything to do with mum after, from Mount Waverley, after she left Dad. But mum also became a rock for other women who were having problems, and then or their husbands had left them. And so there were many nights when I remember where mum was kind of counselling other women or just listening to them about their predicament and advising them on what was the best way to manage this and children, because I think in all of those situations, the fathers didn't have a huge amount of to do with the children. You generally lived with the mother, and also there was the pressure on for work, you know, for women and managing financially, because mum had always worked. She had worked part-time before that, but she, you know, at that time, the disparity between men and women's wages and the kind of jobs that women were able to get was quite different to a man's opportunities, yeah.
What kind of influence do you think seeing your mum take that independent role or that support role had on you? Maybe even one that you weren't aware of at the time, but looking back, I mean, what sort of influence was that to grow up with your mum in that way?
I think two primary things. One was how to be a good friend. That she really, just by observation, mum never mentioned that, but just by observation of mum with other women, she was a mighty friend to other women. And the other thing that I realised later, only from conversations with my peers, and it kind of still, I still become aware of it when I'm speaking to people now, is that I didn't realise that things were unavailable, because she didn't ever say to my sister and I, oh, you can't do this or you can't do that because the world, you know, doesn't offer you that. That was never in that. And because mum did so many things, that I just saw women as completely capable.
Your Auntie Peg, who, as you said, was badly affected by contracting polio as a child, where did she end up living after your Nana passed away?
Ah, well, yes, she went down to a retirement retirement home on the Mornington Peninsula, and her world opened up. It was the first time. It was beautiful, actually. Mum pushed her to do that. Peg was very, very unwilling, but Nana had died and Peg was quite bereft after Nana died, and Mum encouraged her to move. Finally, Peg did, and she was the party girl for many years. It was fantastic because there were so many.
Was she younger than those other? I mean, was she there primarily because of her physical disability?
Yes. So Peg was able to enter in her 50s, but a lot of her friends there were Nana's age. And Peg was always very comfortable with Nana's friends. Her primary source of friendship growing up and as an adult, and her social life was primarily through Nana, and that Nana's friends through the church or the neighbourhood or whatnot. So Peg was completely at home with people that age. And also they saw her as a youngster. And so that was a lovely thing for Peg to enjoy as well, because she was a lot more astute. Peg was a wonderful observer of everything. So it's so interesting with our bodies and our minds when one part diminishes a little bit, in Peg's case, you know, her muscles because of polio, but her sense of observation was as keen as anyone I've ever known. She didn't ever miss anything, whether it be relationships, who did what. Sometimes she spotted, she watched how other people move. So when a young man down the street had actually robbed a bank when we lived at home, she was able to recognise him in a paper from how he stood. And it was him, you know. She said, "Oh, I think that's Bobby. I think it's Bobby." And it was Bobby. She opened up. She had a wonderful time. She had, you know, independent friends of anyone in the family. I remember one Christmas she came and slept through Christmas because she was so exhausted from all her partying beforehand. It was really lovely.
It was in visiting your Auntie Peg at the retirement home that you started chatting to older people, and they shared their memories of going to dance halls during the World Wars, which was something you then pursued as a master's student, your research into the role of these dance halls. Tell me about those kinds of conversations that you had about dance halls, what they were and why they mattered so much that people still wanted to talk about them, you know, decades and decades on?
Yes, well, I'd found a letter from my nana's first fiancé and with the mention of dance halls. Oh, no, a letter, and that had started those conversations. And then all of the people that I spoke to at the retirement centre when I spoke about their lives, they all brought up the dance halls in wartime and how they lifted them and that they gave them the strength to get through the war. They talked about their social lives of what they did. It was, you know, fairly ordered. They played cards or they went to a film on a Friday night, and the dances only went for 3 hours, and it was that limited time. So they could go to a dance on a Friday or Saturday night because there were dances everywhere. If we had dances now, there would be no need for dating apps because you were able to rely on people would go to the dance, and that you would have the opportunity to meet new people. They loved the barn dance. Almost everyone said the barn dance is one of their favourite dances.
What was great about the barn dance?
Because it rotated.
Uh-huh. And they could speed dating.
Yes, they rotated, and they would dance with everyone, and they could touch everyone, and they were close enough to talk to them and also smell them. So, and not to mention moving with them to music, which I think has a particular, you know, is a very special sensory experience. So, I think that because they were only 3 hours, they went from generally 7 to 10 or 8 to 11. And then it was, you know, and they said no alcohol. There was alcohol, of course. The men went outside to the cars and they kept there, or outside where they stashed a bottle of beer or whatnot. But because of that limited time, they were luminous in their memories. And everybody that I asked at the end of my interviews, because it started off in the retirement centre, but then I extended all over Australia, and when I asked their meaning, everyone said the same thing without any prompting, because the question was, what did the dancers mean to you? And they would say the dancers were everything. The dancers were everything for us, because it gave us that 1 3-hour to focus on for the week, to get through the week to this time when, and not for a lot of time, they were not observed. I think that had a lot to do with it. That, you know, in some cases with the community dancers in the country in particular, everyone was there. But a lot of the city dancers, the girls were there, particularly unobserved, unchaperoned, and therefore gave them a lot of freedom.
Well, were these older people frank with you, Lisa, about any intimacy besides dancing that went on in those dance halls?
They all brought up sex.
Really? I mean, they brought it up.
Every single one of them. I'm never going to ask an 80-year-old about their sex life. It's just not going to happen. So I would be talking about, you know, like what, you know, the dance halls, what did you do? And, of course, everyone would say that they were busy dancing. A couple of ladies said, oh, well, you know, I didn't dance. I just sat upstairs with one boy on one side, one on the other. Oh, it was lovely. So there's a whole lot of things that was a subtext to that. But invariable, the men and the women, you know, brought up sex. And they said, oh, you know, like, oh, well, of course we didn't do it back then. Well, I did, but it was different. And because I married my, you know, that partner, and I married Joe, or I married, you know, Simon or whatnot. So it was hysterical. It was almost like by the end of the interviews, because I interviewed a lot of people, I'd be waiting for them to bring up sex, because it was like that they hadn't, you know, let the cat out of the bag, really, what happened. So, of course, you know, they were in their prime there, and particularly in the war, if you're going back, you're on leave and you're going back to war, and you've just got this 3 hours in the company of a woman, or for the women, in the company of a man, or if you think that somebody that you really fancy is going back to war, well, you know, abandon. Yeah. I think it's also this beautiful thing of being with the mass and all of us dancing together as well as with that person. And in their case, there was touch because they were all partner dancers and they knew them. You know, they knew them from school. Part of school was going to dance class. And, you know, I found out crazy things. You know, I found my father's dancing shoes. I didn't know he was a dance champion. Way after, you know, he was ever going to tell me about it. Or mum started a dance club. She didn't tell me that either. Until late in the research or whatnot. But I think that was also this beautiful power, positive power, and that still happens today. I was thinking about it when I was watching Pub Choir, the show on Pub Choir, of how we love to be as a mass and doing things together. It's just this need that we have to commune together. And so dancing with someone in and rotating, this, because everybody is, there's this freedom within that and this confidence it builds to express ourselves physically, which is also an extraordinary human need.
At the end of high school, Lisa, you and your sister Deb went away for the weekend to celebrate. What happened on that trip?
Well, we were going to Wilson's Prom and we were involved in a car accident. Our car ran off the road and I was knocked unconscious. I know my seatbelt failed, and I think the thing after that that I remember was being in the hospital. Deb was also in the hospital. And I think, you know, the tough on Deb because she has a memory of it. I don't have a memory of the accident. So I think it's tougher for her, or was certainly was when the accident happened and in the years immediately afterwards. But it was because of that accident that finally there was a problem with the road. And there had been numerous accidents in that exact spot because of wind getting under the car. It was a wind tunnel, apparently. And as a result of that, I received some compensation when I was at college. And that ultimately changed my life, that compensation.
What do you mean? Why?
Because I had a dance teacher at that time who was from New York, Stanley Burke. And Stanley, I think, recognized in me the hunger and just said, you need to go to New York and study with this person and this person. And it was because I could that I went. I only could because I had that money from the compensation, from the car accident. And so this, what was, you know, a pretty tricky incident turned out to change my life.
Had you travelled overseas much before that trip to New York City?
Never, never.
So what do you remember about arriving in New York? How did it strike you, this city?
Well, I stayed in the youth hostel on 34th Street, and that was wild, I've got to say. So, like, people, you know, all sorts of people. That was my first night in New York City. People are running up and down the hallways, all sorts of people, quite a lot of people who were, you know, affected by chemicals. And I remember one lady asking for help, and I thought, oh, my gosh, you know, this 22-year-old girl from Glen Iris, what's the matter? And she said, here. So I opened the door, of course, to my room. And there she was, straight away dropped her pants and showed me all this huge scar that ran down her leg. And it was big. It was really wide and these massive stitch marks and whatnot. And then asking me for money, and it was just very overwhelming.
Did you think that you should be, you know, heading back to the airport and returning to Glen Iris? Did you feel up to this?
Well, I had a couple of other people, because I'd driven from Colorado, actually, with a couple of other Australians. I didn't know anyone in New York, but I had an intermediary stop in Colorado on the way across, And so I had two other people that were there in New York. And so I connected with them and told them about it. But I was pretty determined to go to these classes that Stanley had told me to. And I did. And I didn't stay with those teachers. I found a different technique completely. But New York was just completely wild and different. And I've got to say, I loved it. I loved the messiness. I loved the craziness. I loved the so many cultures.
And this was, you know, famously before the city got cleaned up. That was a New
peep
York
shows, peep shows everywhere in Midtown. I didn't know Midtown was, you know, I thought, it, you know, we have seen Times Square and everything like that, and I'd read the history books, but I also knew of particular dance companies that, you know, I had really admired, Paul Taylor, Martha Graham, you know, Joyce Trizzle, all of that sort of thing. So that's where my focus was, but I didn't know that I was going to be exposed to so many wonderful people. I didn't know they existed. And musically, I didn't know. I think that was the biggest eye-opener. Like when you do a jazz class or you did a jazz class here, you did a jazz class. But there, the first question is when you said you're going to do jazz, well, whose technique? Because there are about 50 techniques.
So what were the classes like? What was it like to be in the room there in New York?
Incredibly intimidating. But I, you know, I learned to go to the classes that I, you know, I realized that I had to build my technique, really seriously. You know, I remember the when I went to the Clark Center for the first time, I walked into the class, I was watching class just before, you know, I was going to go and get changed ready for mine. And the first image was a row of men with their legs in 6 o'clock and just holding it. So that means that one leg is directly above the head, one leg is on the floor, and they're just holding it and breathing. And that was all very easy, you know, completely in control. It was very, very beautiful and entirely terrifying.
People welcoming? I mean, how did they react? Because I imagine there weren't too many other Australian dancers there at the time.
No, there weren't. And certainly, you know, America's, you know, idea of Australia was really very much that we had kangaroos hopping down Bourke Street. And I think a lot of, you know, the Australians that went there perpetuated that. I think they just kind of let them think that, and then we'd just play it because of Paul Hogan and everything like that. Like, we all carry knives, there's kangaroos. It was ridiculous and frustrating. But people were good. But they're New Yorkers, you know, like, they're busy. There's no please or, you know, at all. Or excuse me. There was no excuse me. I remember that's really, really striking me. People didn't seem to say excuse me, please. No, they just kind of go through.
What about dancing outside of class? Were you going to clubs?
Yes. Generally, I went to gay clubs because my roommate was a gay man who went to clubs, Raymond. I would go out dancing. And you know, gay clubs are brilliant for women to go and dance in because we're safe and they play the best, you know, fantastic music. And African-American clubs too, you know, or Latino clubs, fantastic.
Tell me more about Raymond, this dear friend of yours who you ended up living with. What was he doing in New York City?
He was from New York. He was from the suburbs. And so he wasn't from Manhattan. He moved into Manhattan, I think, when he was a teenager. And he was a hairdresser. He was a hairdresser for salons on Madison Avenue, Park Avenue. So his clientele were the very wealthy. And wow, could they tip. Like his chest of drawers, Raymond didn't bank. He was scared of anything with paperwork. So he would just throw his tips in his chest of drawers. His chest of drawers was not full of clothing. It was full of money. So he would just say, oh, you know, just help yourself if you need anything, because it was just cash. I mean, I did count it one time and go down to the bank and open an account for him. But, so he... pretty conservative. I would say a lot of his clients were quite conservative society people. And they were very reliant on him, so that they would, no problem with calling him at a particular time and say, listen, I've got so-and-so's dinner, it's just come up, can you come over? So he was very fortunate. He made some very good friends out of those people, mm. his clients.
Besides hitting the clubs together, Lisa, how did you and Raymond spend your time? What would you do when you were hanging out?
Well, he liked, we would walk. We loved to walk. I wasn't so crazy about walking because often after you've been in classes at, you know, for a good amount of time, I did three classes a day. And then at the, when I was first in New York, I did three classes a day and I waitressed. I think that I did that for 18 months.
That's a lot of time on your feet.
Yes, yes. So I wasn't too keen to step out and walk. And he could walk the city. I mean, he could walk for hours and hours. And you'd think he would be a bit tired because hairdressing, you know, you're on your feet as well. But no, he loved to walk and see the city. So we would do that. We would go to movies. You know, a lot of our time together was just chatting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Raymond was ridiculous. He was such a Peter Pan sort of person. And so he was fantastic at making fun of everything, and I would make fun of his posture because he had bad posture. However, he said, yes, but because of this bad posture and my focus on the ground, this is how many diamond rings I've found on the street, you know. So, and he had, you know, he was uncannily lucky. Like one time he found a bag of money in a stoop to the apartment block, and he thought, it was just in a paper bag. And he opened it, he thought, oh, somebody's left their lunch or whatever. No, it was a bag of money.
Bag of money. So, keep your eyes on the ground when you're walking in New York City. Did you meet any partners of his? Did he have regular men in his life?
I met people that he fancied, one particular man that he fancied. And I met friends of his, and he had numerous female friends. He had broken up with someone not long before I met him. So, no, there was no ongoing partner while I was living with him.
How do you remember first becoming aware of this mystery illness that was starting to affect your gay friends? What were the early days of that like?
They just started disappearing from class. They just, you know, when I have reflected on my work with the dance halls and the wartime, what the women said about one of the things they missed the most was the noise. Mm. And it was so quiet because the men and the boys were gone and they weren't making all of this ruckus. And I think that there was a similarity with AIDS. It was another war because they just stopped coming to class, particularly if they had a lesion on their face or their body. Obviously with dance, you're in, well, for ballet often a unitard, or men had ballet clothes on, so it's like a singlet that they're wearing, so very exposed. And if the lesions were on their face, they were very self-conscious of them. So they stopped coming to class, and those that did, there was a silence around them as well, because there was the subject that none of us wanted to speak about but knew what was happening. I remember that very much, the tension around, you know, chatting, how are you, and then this space of silence, because I don't think any of us could say it.
Is that because of so much fear around it, or what was behind that silence?
It was a massive amount of fear because, you know, America did not deal health-wise with AIDS in the same way that Australia did. The religious far right had a big influence on that. And we generally didn't say things out loud. Like I told a couple of friends that Raymond was ill, and everyone said, move out, move away. You know, it was the period when people didn't know. It hadn't been clarified how you contracted AIDS. So people were paranoid. You know, families washed down walls after their sons had visited, if they were going to have their sons in their family homes at all. And many sons didn't go in there. They didn't go back home at all. They died alone.
Were you afraid of contracting the disease living with Raymond when you made that decision to stay in the house even after you knew that he had HIV?
Well, there were two parts of it. Yes, I was nervous. I know that. I was nervous. There was part of it that didn't make sense to me, though, because I felt if it was so easily contracted, how could we all be shoved on the subways and we're all breathing the same air, we're squished up at peak hour, why would it not have infected everybody? Why is it this specific groups? And I think it was super, you know, important for people to remember. It was also the haemophiliacs and, unfortunately, people who were addicted to, who injected, but also their babies. There was a program at that time to just encourage people to come up and hold babies in the hospitals because they were never held. And a lot of them that needed to be held to feel human touch, the warmth, they needed to feel a heartbeat.
How did life with Raymond change as he grew sicker with AIDS? What was your role in caring for him?
I was, you know, he was working to start off with, and then gradually as different things happened, we certainly couldn't tell the superintendent of our building. None of that. You couldn't say to anyone, you would be asked to leave the building. There's no doubt about that. I had another friend, my friend Cynthia, her brother also contracted AIDS, and she was in the same situation. And that was a godsend, actually. She was already a very close friend, but we had each other. So a lot of our logistic issues we could speak about, like, say, banking, because I would took over some of the banking for Raymond. She did for her brother as well, taking him to hospital and waiting for appointments, speaking to the Gay Men's Health Crisis to find out what resources were available for support, what groups that he could seek support from. As it turned out, Graham didn't join any group. He said, I can't possibly go to a group with some other people so sick. I'll just start thinking I've got what they've got. So he didn't. And also, you know, dealing with, because Raymond, this was kind of parallel to AIDS, you know, Raymond didn't like doing anything with paperwork. So I did a lot of that.
How long was he ill with the disease for?
It was 5 years. And they had said at the very beginning, 6 months to 12 months. So if I went away, I noticed he became ill. And of course, that's, you know, when there's somebody else in the house and you feel like you've got company, you're a lot more buoyant. And I think that has a big effect on your immune system. But I think that he was quite fortunate in those, you know, having the 5 years. There were a lot of other men that I know did not have that time. And I was in West Side Story, and out of that cast, one man was left standing.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was really tough, really tough.
Is there a particular spot in New York that still really reminds you of him when you
yes.
visit the city now?
Yeah, it's the dancing girls. Because when we were, which is kind of a bit ironic actually, there's a spot, it's on the east side around about 91st Street, and there's a statue of three girls in a circle dancing around a fountain, and we would always go and sit by there. Some of his ashes are there. Some are in Egypt. His sister sent them to a friend that was going to Egypt because he always wanted to go to Egypt. But we would often walk there and sit there, and that's where I go and talk to him. Yeah.
What sort of support was dance for you during those years of your friend's illness?
It was very much home. Dance was home, and it was an enormous place of safety for me, you know, particularly going to class. It's when you go to class, you do know what's going to happen. So very much when I would go to class, I would feel that this was an anchor, that when I went there, everything was the same, that we was there would be all of the mix, the dance schools that I went to, Broadway Dance Centre, Joyce Trisler, Dance Company, Steps, they had a big mix of classes. So there was a big mix of people in the dressing rooms. And there was, you know, it would lift you hearing all of the nonsense that we speak about in the dressing rooms. So, you know, like with people complaining about the last auditions, or they'd be talking about that, you know, so they had been looked over, or they complain about a teacher being too strict or whatever. Boyfriends, girlfriends, anything. A lot of women just talking about stuff. And you would see the same people fairly regularly because people would do the classes at the same time. And I love that. I loved not just the actual class. The class was, I knew what was going to happen in the class. I knew what was expected for me. So it was really secure and was definitely an anchor for me. But I also loved everything around going into class. You know, you could leave the world behind. It's a little microcosm there that's also meshed with your physical expression. So all of those things in communion, just fantastic.
After Raymond's death, you ended up moving back permanently to Melbourne, to Australia. How were you different than the young woman who'd set off at 22 to go to New York City and dance?
Well, I was, I guess, a lot more worldly, in that I had seen a lot more of the world and knew a lot more things existed. I think that I had become a lot more aspirational because I saw, you know, when I was in New York, I did classes with people I'd only read about in history books and seen people perform at such a level. And also had known so many different types of people of all ages from all over the world. And I think that New York, people were there for a reason, because it's not the easiest lifestyle. And so everyone's very focused and absolutely wants to succeed in their area that they have chosen. So there's this drive, and that drive is a norm, you know, people having this drive.
You ended up having two sons, two boys of your own, and It's such a physical thing to have children. Like, in a way, your body stops becoming your own, at least for a certain period of time. How did you find the physicality of having little kids?
Well, yeah, my sons were very, very physical, up at five, no reason to stay in bed. I know it's dark, but there's no reason why we should still be in bed. And also the missiles, my gosh, so physical with everything, but the missiles that were thrown for those first 5 years across the room, like everything becomes a missile. We've had, when they were young, very physical relationship. You know, I'm a very tactile person. And both of my sons, Leon and Eve, are also very, very physical, whether it be in team sports, or Leon did a lot of circus and now does cheerleading. Eve has been a football, cricket man, basketball, futsal, whatever. There's a lot of balls involved there. Very physical, but they've got a very, I enjoyed all of that. I really enjoy being physical anyway, so I'm more than happy to. When they were younger, of course it changes when they don't really want you to play and you can't keep up with them. I mean, they're too good.
You know, you described growing up in this very female household. What had you noticed about being around boys in touch? Was that something different, that aspect of having sons rather than being just around girls and women?
So different. So different and so fantastic. They've taught me a huge amount about men and given me this insight into the depth of men that is not necessarily obvious, certainly from somebody who had grown up only around women. And so I was really nervous of teenage boys. I've always been pretty nervous of men because I hadn't known them. And the boys, you know, I think that what has what struck me first of, oh my gosh, you're both such mush balls. You know, you just love the soft bits and a cuddle that for the longest of time. And you're so tender. I didn't ever know that about men because, and it's possibly how we socialize men, but that really has been a great lesson.
And there's so much communication that can happen with touch with boys. I think as a parent, it doesn't have to be words, but touch can be huge. It is huge in relationship with children.
And both my sons relate very, I've got a very different physical language with both of them. And it's been really, really interesting for me to sort of be super aware of that. Like this works for someone, particularly as, you know, after the teenage years when all of those big cuddles stop. But, you know, sometimes the touch is quite spare. But because of that, it is profoundly important. Say if one of my sons has put his hand on my shoulder or on my back, or it can mean so many different things and be profoundly important and impactful at that time.
Even just sitting close to someone,
can
be full of support and meaning.
Sitting in, you know, in the tricky times, just being in that physical presence. That's kind of what I was, another example of that energy of space and how it changes as we change our spatial relationship, and that energy changes, the tension changes, the everything changes within it. So having that proximity, or even whether or not you're close enough to feel their heat, can be further than that, but just being in the space can be enormously consoling for somebody. Can make them feel incredibly secure at one with that person. It's a form of really having their back. I'll just be with you.
Lisa, it's been really fascinating to speak with you on Conversations. Thank you so much for being my guest.
Oh, thank you. It's been a real honour.
Lisa Petty was my guest on Conversations today. This story was produced by Alice Moldovan and recorded on the lands of the Yagara and Turrbal peoples and the peoples of the Kulin Nation. Our executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations. For more Conversations episodes, head to ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.